This is Jack Leffler. The 13-part radio series which follows will provide sound portraits of the American West. We'll listen to the words of many people of different cultures and distinct points of view as to how they have sought and continue to seek to live in harmony with their respective habitats. We'll also hear the voices of many other species who inhabit the various bioregions of Western America. We'll perceive the landscape as a mosaic of interrelated, slowly changing ecosystems, rather than as a human expression of geopolitical entities, and will hopefully come to understand that our species is but one of many in the community of life. Our radio series is committed to the preservation of biotic and cultural diversity and to following a community of practice that is in balance with our home ecosystems. In this way, we honor the spirit of place. Gary Paul Nabhan is an ethnobotanist and co-founder of Native Seed Search. He is an award-winning author whose books include Gathering the Desert and The Desert Smells Like Rain. He's a strong advocate in behalf of traditional culture and has long recognized the role of folklore, folk song, and oral history in the preservation of the spirit of place.
To restore the land, we have to restory it. And I think this is a key element, that whether the stories come to us through poetry or oral history, Odyssey and other epic narratives, or whether it comes to us through some combination of music and performance. These ritualized stories tell us who we are and relate us to the land in a way that reminds us of that relationship. And it reminds us in a way that is not just a head way, but a heart way and a gut way, to remember our relationship to the land, that we are part of the land community. Its story is, in a very real sense, our story. And people who forget the story of their relationship to the land are the people most vulnerable on this planet. Bill Kittredge, in his recent book, Who Owns the West, says that it is not simply a fact that individuals can forget their story, their autobiography, but whole cultures are doing it now. And he feels that in the American West, the Anglo-American culture has forgotten its story, or determined that its original story of the frontier epic is now obsolete. It's not guiding us anymore. And that we need to find a deeper story. How can we find those very ancient connections to the land and build upon them so that we have a bedrock solid sense of place?
The Colorado Plateau is one of the most beautiful provinces on our planet. It is characterized by red rock canyons carved by watercourses which comprise the watershed of the mighty Colorado River. This arid plateau is dotted with piñon and juniper trees and weird rock formations which have provided mythic coordinates for cultures both known and unknown for time out of mind. Vernon Masayesva is a member of the Hopi tribe. He is an educator and has served as chairman of the Hopi Tribal Council.
So I think we have to begin the education process, beginning with the kindergarten students, teaching them how important water is. Because in a Hopi way I was taught, Masao had only three things, he told us. He had a gourd of water, an ear of corn, and a planting stick. He said, this is all I have. And my life revolves around these three things. And that if we want to stay here with them, we have to do the same. That's what we were taught. the corn represents us people, our soul. The gourd of water is our connection to the Creator. It is given when we do the right thing. It's a blessing. And the planting stick is a tool. It's technology. So the basic idea is that we have to use technology to keep our environment healthy. If it's sick, to cure it. You know, we have to use technology to keep ourselves healthy and keep our connections to the Creator strong, not to sever it. If we don't do this, the technology will go on its own and it'll replace God. And that means we're getting ready for the next world. It means that there is going to have to be a cleansing.
Annie Khan is a respected member of her community. She lives near the Lukachukai Mountains in Navajo country.
Since I'm a Navajo, I know the land very well. And I feel very, very good on the land. I always look forward to get up in the morning so I can see the mountains and the valley. And that's immediate blessing when I wake up. This is not true if you live in the cities. They're just like canyons, but you're not allowed to see real mountains. You're not allowed to walk real earth. There's cement everywhere. You don't live very long that way. You get sick. And that's not real living. Before the real sheep come, we had what we call mountain sheep, mountain goats. These animals were very wild. We know they're good. We know they're delicious. We know that they go with the wind. We know that they walk high mountains. We know that they're very spiritual. They leap high and with grace. And so before the coming of Spaniards, we huddled together as a tribe and we prayed for the sheep to come. Of course, in our mind, we see the mountain sheep. We call it rock sheep. We want to pray to kind of a sheep herder, sacred sheep herder. And this sheep herder that we're speaking of is the one look after the mountain sheep and mountain goats. So in our minds, we pray to that particular sheep herder. And we said, share your meat with us. We would like to have some in our own backyard so that we can care for them, as in return, they will feed us. This caring that you do for your mountain animals, we like that idea. Can you share with us? And when we did this in our prayers, we had a vision, spiritual vision, that it would come, then the new people will come and they will bring their sheep with them. And so we prayed, and when they came, they brought their guns. Of course, we weren't praying for the guns. We weren't looking for chaos. We were looking for sheep to come. But when they came, it belonged to these people. We know that that's ours. We went out there and negotiated with them. Somehow they were very careless, and some of these animals escaped or they got left behind. So we caught them and cared for them and we raised them. That's how the second domestic animals come to join us.
Shanta Begay is an internationally recognized Navajo artist and poet who has lived outside his culture but has returned to his homeland.
My whole world was my horizon. Nothing else existed beyond it. That was my world. This is what nurtured me. This is what gave me strength and life. And my whole prayer echoed from one valley to the other and back again and up into the sun. And this was a fantastic place. I knew every arroyo in the valley, almost every gopher holes. And the mother was always there, my mother, my real mother. But the earth mother was something that was always tread upon very lightly. And everything we do, every teaching that we were given, every stories, I guess every songs, everything we do had to do with that, about treading lightly. Certain places you go, you don't go too much in such and such direction, or a certain place. And of course we move with the season. It also added a great deal of mysticism, I guess is what it is. Because I didn't see my winter sheep camp in the summertime. So in my view, in the summertime, when I'm down the valley at the cornfield, I used to think that where we spend the winter right now, there's snow. So the earth itself, you know, created great mystery. There was no skyscraper or superhighway to really slash my world, divide my world, to dissect it. There was no coal mine, there was no traffic, there was no supermarket anywhere near that skewed my vision. You know, my world was just a little tiny sticks, horned toad, coyotes, occasional dust devils. This is what I was a part of, what I am a part of. And taught to be a part of and taught to respect, taught to live with. The wind here in Kayenta is scouring, very abrasive, very hot. Sometimes I hear people cursing it and yelling and screaming. I occasionally catch myself starting to say things like that, but I know this is all part of the street puzzle, and it's good. Because I live in the city for a number of years, and experiencing traffic, experiencing smog, experiencing all that negative of the city, I realize, hey, with all the wind, with all the heat and the dry and the dryness, with all the harshness, there's a great deal of beauty and a great deal of holiness here. It'll always be here, and I'm glad to be back here. I know that after living in the city for a long time.
Fisher people have lived throughout the watershed of the Columbia River for many thousands of years. Long ago, they were able to develop intertribal communities of practice that sustained them without destroying their collective habitat. Ed Edmo is descended from Shoshone Bannock, Yakima, and Nez Perce Indians. He has lived much of his life near the Columbia River in the Dalles, Oregon.
Well, I started fishing actually when I was 7 years old. I caught my first fish. It's a little jacksam, they call it a jacksam. I caught it with a net. It must have been about that long, which is about a foot and a half. A person fishes called set netting, and he misses the fish, and we get a chance to fish for it. So he missed the fish, and I took a dip, and I caught the fish. And I was 7 years old, I remember that. My father and I have the picture somewhere. We got a picture of that. And I was holding it up like this and brought it home and ate it. That was way back in 15. Then I used to fish around Slalo on the rock stuff at different places. And when I turned 13, I got to fish with my uncles and my father. I had four places to fish. I had with my uncle by the falls, my uncle at the channel, and an uncle in Chinook Rock, and another one on Chinook Rock, which was kind of like a distant uncle. And we all take turns. I learned how to make my nets and fish with the men. I used to sit there and fish with the men when I was 13 years old. And that was kind of like a thrill, because all my cousins were playing. I was fishing, making a living. It was kind of interesting.
Gene Hillis is a lifelong artist who has been fascinated by Indian rock art and artifacts, whose presence suggests that people have lived in the bioregion of the Columbia Plateau for over 10,000 years.
On small carvings that were found in middens, there are faces like this, and the bone can be dated. The best things are from 12 to 15,000 years ago.
The rock art of this bioregion reflects a mythic reality which has shaped the human cultures that have evolved and intermingled here.
There's a petroglyph over a little west of Horse Thief Lake called See Who Watches. and it's a petroglyph of supposed to be a lady, I think, sister, that eyes, and she watches everybody. It's quite a thing.
One time, Coyote was walking the river, and he decided, didn't have anything else to do. He was going to find the wisest person on the river. So he went from village to village, and he would ask, who is the wisest person in your village? And then when he was satisfied, he would move on. He came to this little place along the Columbia River. It was a lovely place because there were little sloughs where they could catch water birds. There were fish. There were enough roots and tules and plants that they could use. So people stayed there, and they had a little village there. Coyote came by, and he said, and who is the wisest person in your village? And someone would say, oh, it's that old lady who lives up on the hill. She's good to us. So he went a little further and said, and who is the wisest person in your village? And, oh, it's that old lady. She's been here a long time. She knows what to do. So he went from person to person. So finally he went up to talk to the old lady. And she talked to him, and he said, is it true? Are you really the wisest person in your village? And she said, well, I try to be. I try to see that people get along. I try to see that parents are good to their children. I try to see that people have enough to eat. I try to be. He said, all right. I guess you are the wisest person in your village. And with that, he took her and he threw her up across the cliffs and he said, there, you can watch over your village forever.
Sharon Dick is a fisherwoman who lives on the Yakima Indian Reservation. She maintains a fishing platform on the Columbia River where she catches and dries salmon after the traditional fashion of her people. In the course of her lifetime, she has witnessed a spectacular decrease in salmon populations in the Columbia River watershed due to construction of massive dams, pollution from pesticides and nuclear waste, and unchecked offshore salmon fishing. She fears that should the current trend continue, salmon will finally disappear from their home watershed.
Our first food is the salmon. It's important for us to have salmon. Every Sunday we're supposed to eat salmon. It's our way of life to thank the Creator on Sunday and eat the traditional foods. And that's a lot of salmon. And the way I see the numbers declining, it's really scary for me. The Indian people used to walk so close to nature. The Columbia River, you know, was clean flowing water. At one time they said you could see all the way to the bottom. It was so clean. And I think way back then when the fish were in great numbers and they came in, they went to their streams and they were hardy fish. And now they're not. And I think like the dams warm up the water. And yet a fish can't, you know, like go from, like we can walk from the hot sun into air conditioning room. They can't do that. Their body temperature has to adjust before they can move. And when they come into that mouth, they got one thing in mind. They're going to spawn. And then they have to fight all these things, different elements and things, you know, water temperature. And they're coming a long ways. When they leave here, they're just little bitty things. And yet they go out there and they feed and they come back. And that big salmon that comes back, you know, he's got a real long battle from the mouth of the Columbia clear up to Wenatchee, fighting all the different dams and, you know.
Alan Pinkham is a Nez Perce Indian whose role is to communicate the point of view of his people to government agencies in order to forestall continued destruction of habitat, which results in endangerment and extinction of species.
If you relate your body parts to individual species that have been eradicated from this North American continent, if you relate the peregrine falcon to your little finger, and your buffalo to another finger, or maybe the sockeye salmon up to your elbow? When would you stop sacrificing your body parts to save a species? If you relate your body to your Mother Earth and the environment, that's another way of thinking. But if you do that, you'll start to understand the way Indians feel about Mother Earth. Let's not sacrifice one species for another. Let's restore the habitat. Let's restore the species. Because if you relate that to body parts, when are you going to say no? No more extraction, utilization to extinction of species.
The headwaters of the Rio Grande spring from the San Juan Mountains along the eastern aspect of the San Luis Valley and flow for nearly 2,000 miles before they empty into the Gulf of Mexico. Communities of Puebloan Indians have lived within the northern Rio Grande watershed since well before the coming of Europeans. Even today, their cultures are bound closely to the arid land.
I guess I was meant to be a potter the day when I was born, because my mother has been a potter all her life. And I've been surrounded with potters all these many years, and it just came natural for me to take up pottery making, and I've been at it all this time.
Dolores Lewis is an Acoma potter whose family are widely known for the artistic excellence of their craft.
When I put my design on my bowl, it gives me a relaxation, and it gives me a good feeling that I'm able to do design on a pottery. And it gives me a good inspiration, because all these designs that are on the pottery all pertain back to Mother Nature. When you turn your pottery bowl like this, you're able to put water in it, you're able to put your cornmeal in there, you're able to put food in it, and you're able to drink from the pottery. It gives me a good feeling when I start putting my design on. I don't usually just play with it, because this is my lifetime. It's going to take me up till the day that I'm ready to leave the earth. And I'm going to leave the earth by taking a piece of pottery with me, like my ancestors have done long ago. So I'll be able to carry my water in one of my potteries when I go.
Four centuries ago, Spanish colonists trekked northward along the Rio Grande and sank roots into the arid landscape that was defined by mountain ranges and high valleys or basins. Cleofas Vigil speaks of the new race that came to be when Spaniards and Indians intermarried.
No somos puros españoles, no somos puros vascos, ni puros franceses, pero ni puros indios, ni puros mexicanos. Es una raza nueva que muchos de ustedes, los educators, han descubierto, that we are a new race de españoles, vascos, franceses, entreverada con indios. Sí, lo que, si va uno a la historia para atrás de los primeros españoles que vinieron al mundo nuevo, no trajeron españolas, beautiful Spanish señoritas de España. They found beautiful Indian girls. And they married Indian girls. And there's where this new race came, which I'd rather be called a Chicano than Español or Mexicano or Frances, even though probably I look too much europeo, pero la sangre está mezclada con indio. Cuando que 10, 20 o posible 100 años, cuando los pilgrims trompezaron con Plymouth Rock, y hacía casi 100 años que estaba esa nación nueva en las montañas de la sangre de Cristo, isolated. Our ancestors were isolated from the rest of the world for about 100 years. Sure, los indios los corrieron, but they came back. Aquí está su querencia.
The music of the Hispano Rio Grande del Norte still reflects the tie of the people to the land. Cipriano Vigil performs his composition, Se ve triste el hombre.
Entra el hombre cuartonero a las entrañas de la sierra, saca todos los pinos y nos dejan sin madera, saca todos los pinos y nos dejan sin madera. Las montañas de mi tierra en un tiempo de mi gente fueron, cuando entraron las florestas todititos recogieron, cuando entraron las florestas todititos recogieron. Se ve triste el hombre de la sierra, pues destrozaron la naturaleza, le quitaron el agua y su tierra. Destrozaron la naturaleza, le quitaron el agua y su tierra. Hay que preservar lo nuestro, ya basta de mi casa es suya, no tenemos leña verde ni para cocer tortillas, no tenemos leña verde ni para cocer tortillas. En los tiempos de mi abuelo, cuando cercas no existían, de esta piedra que el pinito es la tierra mía, de esta tierra que el pinito es la tierra mía.
Featured on this episode of The Spirit of Place have been Gary Paul Nabhan, Ed Edmo, Gene Hillis, Sharon Dick, Alan Pinkham, Vernon Masayasva, Annie Kahn, Shanto Begay, Cleophas Vigil, Cipriano Vigil, and voices of other species who live in the American West. This 13-part radio series was produced for the Western States Arts Federation in association with KUNM-FM Albuquerque by Jack Leffler and Elaine Thatcher. Funding for this series was provided by the Ruth Mott Fund, the New Mexico Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Utney Reader Magazine, offering thought-provoking points of view on culture and society from over 2,000 media sources. Please visit Utney Reader on the World Wide Web at utney.com. That's www.utne.com. This is Jack Leffler inviting you to remain attuned to the spirit of place. Thank you for listening.
Esos tiempos se acabaron, nos quitaron toditito, ahora nos miran y se ríen y nos ven como tontitos, ahora nos miran y se ríen y nos ven como tontitos. Se ve triste el hombre de la sierra, pues destrozaron la naturaleza, nos quitaron el agua y la tierra. Pues destrozaron la naturaleza, nos quitaron el agua y la tierra.